We're shifting right now. We're shifting our series. We've been studying 2 Corinthians, right? We've been doing that for a good portion of the last few months. We're going to shift just for the summer to a new series, a summer series, where we're going to take a second look at familiar stories that you may have heard growing up in children's church, in Sunday school, or whatever version your church may have done of that. And we're going to take a look at those stories. And so this is our story series. This is volume number 3 because we've done this two other times. In the Old Testament, but this time we're going to study the New Testament. And so when we get to our text this morning, we're going to be in Mark chapter 6. Mark chapter 6, and if you grabbed one of the Bibles that we provide for you there in the back, it's on page 864. Mark chapter 6, but page 864 in those Bibles. So maybe growing up, as you remember your children's church teachers or your Sunday school classes, and you remember one of the stories that you heard. Maybe you had a favorite. Maybe there was one that stuck out to you, and maybe it was a favorite because there was a song that went with it, or the flannel graph that the teacher used, was one of your favorites because of the way they were moving around. And I'll be honest, I don't really remember which of the stories that they told were my favorites. I just remember that the Tylers, there was Miss Tyler and Mrs. Tyler. Mrs. Tyler and her daughter, Miss Tyler, they always gave us gum. And that was my favorite thing in that. They always gave us gum, but they always gave us the cinnamon, the one that burned your mouth, right? Remember? And then you were like, oh, this is bad, right? And then you got a drink of water, and when you drink the water, you were like, oh, this makes it worse, right? For whatever reason, that gum, a drink of water, always like refreshed it and made it, yeah, anyway, that was me. I was weird. But they told you those Bible stories, right? And so maybe you had, favorite stories, and a lot of those maybe were in the Old Testament, right? Maybe yours was Jonah. That was one of your favorite ones. You loved hearing it, or you loved being the Jericho people walking around the walls, right? But maybe you had some New Testament ones that you really loved. And so you had your favorites, but maybe you didn't. Maybe you didn't grow up in church, and you weren't going to children's church or Sunday school, and so you didn't hear those versions of the Bible stories, and you're not really too familiar with some of them, right? That we would call Bible stories. And there may be a few that you've heard, right? You've heard some of the details as you've grown up, and so you're familiar with a little bit of some of those, but either way, we're going to revisit them, and we do them a little bit of a disservice by calling them Bible stories, because it suggests that there's a possibility that they're just that, they're just stories, and because we teach them first to kids, and we use pictures and songs and worksheets and flannel graphs and all of those different things, sometimes we miss the truth of the story for the details of the story, where we remember the details, but we miss, sometimes we miss the truth. And it's important, I'm not saying don't teach them to kids, it's important to teach them to kids, but as we grow up, as we get farther and farther away from hearing those, they become stories to us, and we forget the truth. And sometimes that's because the stories include miracles. And they become, in some minds, they become more legends or fables to people because they can kind of seem like fantasy. But the reality is, Bible stories aren't just stories. They're real events with real people, and they're part of God's revealed words to us in order to teach us truth, to help us understand God and His truth and the world in a biblical way. So this is our third summer, as I mentioned, studying and revisiting what some would consider to be children's Bible stories. But they aren't just those stories. And maybe, just for the next few weeks, maybe we can take off the lens of fable and discover the truths in the accounts, in the events. And so we're going to the New Testament. We're going to take a practical look at 10 of the most popular New Testament Bible stories. If you were to look in a children's Bible, you will find that the stories that we're going to look at are the most repeated, the most included stories in children's Bibles. And we're going to see what they're there to teach us. What can they teach us? And so we're going to start with the only miracle performed by Jesus that's recorded in all four of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And so this is the only one that all four of them teach us and tell us about. And so that's the feeding of the 5,000. Feeding the 5,000. It's in Mark chapter 6, verses 30 to 44. It's also in Matthew, Luke, and John. But we're going to look at Mark's account, pull in some details from the other ones, and we're going to find those truths that should impact us today. So Mark chapter 6, and I'm going to begin in verse 30, and I'm going to read that for you here. So Mark chapter 6, verse 30, the apostles gathered around Jesus and reported to him all that they had done and taught. That's where we're beginning. That's just going to give us the background. That's going to give us the context. And so this event, this verse tells us that the event starts with a gathering of the 12 disciples, but you'll notice that he calls them the apostles, right? Mark calls them the apostles. It's the same 12 guys, but there's a reason he calls them apostles, and that's because of what they were just doing, right? And he tells us that they gather together with Jesus, and that gathering, and the reason he calls them apostles, and that they're giving this report of all that they had done and taught, gives us a need for context. What are you talking about, right? What do you mean? So where were they? Why are they gathering? What reports are they giving? And so this is year 3 of Jesus's ministry, his public ministry, and after 2 years of discipling these men, these 12 men, teaching them and shaping them and helping them process what it means that Jesus is now here, as he's been preaching, you know, the kingdom of God is here and people need to repent. He's been preparing them to be his witnesses and share the good news of salvation and the kingdom of God. And so he begins to send them out on their own in pairs. And that's why Mark calls them apostles, because they're commissioned. They were sent out to go carry on this ministry and be his witnesses. And so he sent them on these in pairs missions to preach and heal. He sent them out on little mini mission trips to various villages around to preach and heal and preach that people should change their thinking and change how they're living and what they're believing, because the rule of God has returned in the person of Jesus. And so he sent them out in pairs to preach that, to teach that and then confirm that the rule of God has returned in the person of Jesus. He's the one that sent us, and then they were going to perform some miracles to support what they were claiming, right? That what they were saying, to substantiate that truth. And he gave them the authority to heal sickness and cast out demons. Go preach this, and then if someone says, yeah, I don't believe that, or I'm not sure about that, show them by saying, well, he gave us the authority to do this. Something that people wouldn't naturally be able to do, something that only God actually could do or should be able to do. And so they return in verse 30 from that ministry to debrief with Jesus. They come back to have kind of a gathering, to go over details. But that ministry, as you can imagine, they're preaching some pretty substantial things, right? That the rule of God has returned, because the Jews were waiting for that. But it's in the person of Jesus, which is a little bit unexpected. And so now the question is he going to be a king, or is this something else? And they were creating some ripples and some waves because of all the healing and the miracles they were doing. And so this caused a commotion, right? And it's a promotion of Jesus and his ministry. And the gospel was very effective, and it drew a lot of attention. Okay, so they've come back to debrief. But that's what Mark tells us, verse 31. Because so many people were coming and going while they were trying to do this with gathering with Jesus, they did not even have a chance to eat. And he said to them, to the disciples, come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest. So they went away by themselves in a boat to a solitary place. So here's what Mark tells us, right? They came back. They were on these missions trips. They were making some significant progress with sharing the gospel, sharing the good news. But on that particular day, when they come back, there wasn't much of a break for anyone. I don't know what their responsibilities were between all the 12. When Jesus is, and this is me trying to picture this, when Jesus is preaching, where are the disciples and what are they doing? They're doing something, right? And they each have, and we know for example, we know what Judas is kind of doing, right? Because as Jesus is preaching and sharing, people are bringing contributions. Right, and so Judas is over there, you know, making collections, and maybe he's got a table and he's set it up and he's collecting and keeping track of that. But the other guys, where are they? They have responsibilities, right? You know, and some of them we see later on, some of them see themselves as gatekeepers, right? Not quite bodyguards, but they're checking people who want to go see Jesus, right? They do this with the children, and Jesus is like, stop doing that with the kids later on, right? He tells them, stop doing with the kids. But they all have responsibilities, and so they gather with Jesus to debrief, and then the crowds start coming, and so they go into, Judas, set up your table, right? You guys go out, start doing your thing. People are coming to see Jesus. He's preaching, right? They all have a role. They all have something they do. And so this causes, you know, more things, right? Being involved in side conversations and maybe doing their own teaching, right? Because, you know, maybe Jesus isn't projecting his voice. And so people are saying, what's he talking about? Well, here's what he's saying, right? And here's what he's doing. And maybe they have that kind of a role, but they all kind of go into ministry mode when these people start showing up. They're co-ministers. They're extensions of Jesus's ministry. But the business of ministry, what we're seeing here in verse 32 with Jesus on this day, was nonstop. And Mark points out that the disciples, they get back and they haven't even had a chance to have anything to eat. And Jesus recognizes that the disciples they're spent. It's been a long, long ministry out there. They've been traveling. They got back to get some, you know, refreshment, and here come the people. And Jesus can't resist, right? Can't turn this away. And so the ministry continues. It's nonstop. And so Jesus recognizes that the disciples have really lost a lot of their energy, and their regroup wasn't really a regroup. And you've probably had Saturdays like that, right? Where you are, you know, by Tuesday, you're thinking, I cannot wait for Saturday, right? I need some time. I need a few minutes. I need a couple hours to just take it easy. And then Saturday doesn't turn into a Saturday, right? Everything happens at the same time, or you didn't realize how long this project was going to take, or somebody calls and says, hey, I need your help. Can you come help me? And Saturday is not Saturday. And now you're thinking, well, I guess maybe next weekend. Next weekend we'll get that break. Next week when we'll have that opportunity or that chance. And this is kind of where the disciples are at. This was supposed to be a regroup, and instead we've got a crowd. And Jesus recognizes this and says, guys, we got to get some rest, don't we? And they kind of go, yeah, we do. And so Jesus tells them, let's go away. This is verse 31. Let's go away by ourselves and take a break. Let's get some rest. Let's find a quiet place to rest. And so that's what they do. But one of the things that we should do when we read this, as we read stories, events like this, is see ourselves in the people involved. This isn't about us, but they're for us, and we can relate very easily, I think, to the people involved. And relate to what they're going through. And so these disciples are spent, and they've pushed themselves to the point where they aren't eating, and they just need that time away. And I'm sure you felt that. I'm sure you felt that need for rest, that life pushes you so much that you don't have time to breathe, it feels like. And you just want a chance, just for a minute, I need to sit down, I need to just take a minute, shut everything out, and have that time. And maybe like the disciples here, it's the tensions of relationships that they weigh on you, and you get to the end of the day, and then you notice the house is a disaster, and you haven't gotten to it yet, and you have that crisis of like, I need to sit down, but I need to do the dishes, and then I need to do this and that, right? And or work has been demanding, and you didn't have time for groceries, but you really just want to take a minute. Right? Or your project list has grown, not decreased. Feels like the more that you do, it just gets longer, not less. Or maybe it's because, you've got the family, scheduled, necessarily scheduled, and you've got so many different directions that you're going that you come back and you're like, it's 10 p.m. It's late and I got to get back to it tomorrow morning, or maybe things, just get away from you and you forget to pay the bills and now you're looking at doing that when you want to sit, or you're going to bed 3 hours later and getting up way too soon and you recognize what they're going through, like, I just need to rest. I just need a minute. And life is tough. And in particular, when we live out Jesus's call in our life, the truth is it doesn't always get easier, and less busy. When we live our role that Jesus has called us to, it can be tough. And there are moments, if we were honest, and you can be honest, and it's okay to feel this and recognize this, there are moments living out the role that God has called you to that we are just fatigued. We just get tired. Don't feel weak if following God's call in your life to that role, in serving Him wears you down and brings that fatigue. It's not a flaw, right? It is, the disciples are not flawed for feeling that need for rest. You living out your role, following God in that role, in and of itself, is going to bring fatigue. It's normal. That's not a weakness. That's not a flaw to notice and recognize, I need a break. Not from the role. I just need a rest. I need a moment. And I'm sure we've all had those days where maybe not literally, maybe literally, but we would say, I didn't even have a chance to eat today. It was just that one of those days, and recognize we need rest. And Jesus recognizes this in the disciples, that they're tired, that life is getting tough. And so, hey guys, let's take a break. Verse 31, let's take a break. Come with me by yourselves. Don't bring the relationships with, don't bring the ministry with you for now. Let's go to a quiet place and get some rest. Now, the NIV and the NLT, if you're looking at those versions, tell us that Jesus suggests going to a quiet place, or a quiet place to rest. But if you're reading like the English Standard Version or the King James Version or one of those, you'll see that he says, let's go to a desolate place. That's actually more the word that Jesus uses, deserted, desolate, dry land, a place people don't usually go for recreation. That's what Jesus tells them. Hey, let's go to a really barren spot and get some rest and get some R&R. And Mark emphasizes this. He wants us to notice this, that Jesus says that this is where they're going, not just in quoting Jesus, let's go to a quiet place, not just in that quote, but in highlighting it again in verse 32, they went away by themselves in a boat to a solitary place, and then again by citing the disciples in verse 35, where they say this is a remote place. All of those are actually the same word. It's a deserted place. It's a dry land. It's a barren place. Jesus, what he's doing is Jesus takes his disciples who need rest to get rest in the desert, in the wilderness. That's where he takes them. That's where he says, hey, not, hey, let's go to the beach, or let's go to a nice wooded area that's shaded, it's got some, figs or fruits where we can just kind of pick and eat and just, lay out a blanket and have a nice breeze. And he says, let's go to the wilderness and get some rest. That's what he says. And when you read that, maybe the disciples didn't think this, but when I read that, I go, that's a little odd. It's a little bit unusual to say, let's go to the desert. Jesus recognizes they need refreshment, they need nourishment, they need conversation and encouragement. So he says, let's go somewhere desolate. How's that sound, guys? There's a desert near here. Happens to be a short boat ride away, just north of the Sea of Galilee. Let's head there. Everybody, get in the boat. Let's go. And this place that he takes them to, what we find out is there's really no villages nearby. Not close. Not really close. It's very remote. It's, in fact, deserted and dry. It's a great place to get refreshed, right? So that's not their choice, probably. I would imagine. And, in fact, some of them live near here. They have family in various places nearby, and maybe not their first choice, but they follow Jesus. It just says, get in the boat, let's go. All right, you must know something we don't know. And so they follow Jesus, rest is needed. That part sounds nice. So they get in a boat and they go to the desert. And Mark really wants us to know, as he reinforces this is the wilderness. I don't know if you have, you know, when you want to rest, if you have a favorite spot you'd like to go, where you just need that quiet. You know, maybe some of you are fishermen and you just will go out to a pier, you know, at the beach, and you cast a line and that's where you go to just get that quietness. Maybe some of you, it's just the back patio, you know, where it's quiet. You can watch nature, you can watch the birds, whatever it might be. You know, some of you, maybe it's your basement. You know, you like to go down, start working on something, start doing something, but clear your head, you get your rest, you get your quiet. You know, everybody kind of has. You maybe have your favorite ideal spot where if I were to go get some rest, if I could go get some quiet right now, this is where I go. And it may surprise you to know that God also has one of those spots. God also has a favorite spot that he wants to go. He likes to go to get quiet and to get rest. And there's some biblical context here that gives us a foreshadowing that in the wilderness, the desolate places in the Old Testament and in Jewish history, that's God's favorite place to go get rest. God loves bringing people to the wilderness for this purpose. Sometimes he tests them there, and maybe you can think of some examples where God leads someone into the wilderness to test them. Sometimes he meets them, he always meets them there. He brings someone to the wilderness because he wants to meet them. Sometimes he refreshes them there. How many times, if you read the Old Testament, where God says, meet me in the wilderness, and then there's, like in the case of Elisha, there's bread waiting at the bottom of a tree, right? And he says, eat here, you know? He brings him to the wilderness to meet them there, to bless them sometimes, test them, refresh them. And this is God's spot. This is what God loves to do. And so it's not surprising. It shouldn't be surprising to us then that God the Son says, we all need some rest, right? I got a spot. It's a spot I have always loved to go. Let's go to the wilderness because this is where I go to refresh. It shouldn't surprise us at all that this is what he says, because this is God's spot. And so, guys, you're tired, you've been busy, I need you to meet me in the wilderness. Let's grab a boat. Look at verse 33. So verse 32, they go in the boat to a solitary place. But many who saw them leaving recognized them and ran on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. So what happens is they actually have to go to where the boats are. They have to go to the port. So it's not like the boats are just sitting there off the shore and they hop in the boat, right? There's a dock. They have to go. And so Jesus basically tells them, you know, you guys slip away. You head down to the docks, get in the boat. I'm going to meet you, right? We're going to go there. We're going to have a rest there. And so when they get to the docks, somebody notices, hey, those are the disciples. That's their boat. Right? Oh, I wonder where they're going. Those were the guys that were doing that healing and ministering thing, right? Those are the guys that lead you to Jesus, right? They're the ones that know where he is. I bet they're going to his next place. I bet they're going to his next stop, right? And so they see them. So verse 33, they saw them leaving and they recognized them. And so people ran on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. And when Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd, so he began teaching them many things. So the disciples take the boat, and one of the things that we can see from the geography is they're not going across the lake. They're not going across the Sea of Galilee. They're cutting off the northern end of it. It's about a 4 or 5 miles across where they're going. They're still going over some pretty deep spots in the lake, but they're going about 5 miles across, so they're not far enough away from shore that nobody can see them. They can see the sail of the boat. They can kind of track the boat as they follow it along the shore. And so some of them see it, right? Some of the people see the boat and they book it across the shore. They start following it along the shoreline and catch the disciples and Jesus when they get off the boat at the desolate place, at the wilderness, where they were supposed to rest with Jesus. And so there goes that plan. So much for that plan, because the crowd catches up, and then the crowd grows as more and more come to get more of what Jesus was giving, to hear more of what he was teaching. And so later on, we're going to see that Mark tells us at the end in verse 44 that there are 5,000 men here. There's 5,000 men that follow them to the wilderness. And that's because, now, that's because they only count men during those times. Mark would have only, and hearing this from Peter too, you know, Peter was there, they were only counting men. But commentators agree that when you include women and even children that would have come with them, that there were likely with the men, you're looking at least at 10,000 people, more likely 15,000 people, following them to this desolate, this wilderness. That's a huge crowd that follows Jesus and the disciples into the wilderness. And because he's the image of God, he's the expression of God as a man, full of grace and truth, Jesus reacts to this huge crowd and must have shared later with his disciples, because Mark tells us what he was thinking. He must have shared later on with the disciples, who maybe were asking him, I thought we were getting rest. Why did we start into this ministry again? Right? He must have shared later his thoughts, because Mark says that Jesus didn't see the people as a nuisance. Mark says that what Jesus was thinking when he saw them was that these are sheep without a shepherd. And so, full of grace and truth, God in flesh sees sheep without a shepherd and goes, guys, I can't pass up an opportunity. I can't miss a chance to minister to people like this when they need this spiritual direction. They're spiritually directionless. They need a shepherd. They need a guided. And so, notice, he just starts teaching. He doesn't start giving them the healings. He doesn't start performing miracles. He sees people that need spiritual leadership, spiritual guidance, and so he starts teaching them, and meeting that need, giving them what they're missing in the wilderness. Now, not only should we see ourselves in these events and say, okay, if I was a disciple, what would I be thinking? Or if I was a person there, not only should we see ourselves when we read the events, we're especially meant to see Jesus. We're meant to see Jesus for who he is. And here we see that Jesus demonstrates, and this is important to remember as we go on in life, as we interact with him and follow him, that Jesus' first concern is not to send away the people because of the intrusion, right? This, his concern is to supply their spiritual needs. And Jesus demonstrates that as God, his greatest priority is our spiritual health. His greatest priority is meeting our spiritual needs. And God, what we learn here is that God will always prefer to meet spiritual needs as or before he meets needs of convenience. God will always prefer to meet your spiritual needs and address your spiritual health before or during or while he's meeting your needs of convenience. That's his first priority. And so he sees, you know, the disciples have a need of convenience. And he looks at all these people and goes, yeah, but here's the thing. I got to address spiritual needs. I have to address spiritual needs. And so this is a really good lesson for us to remember, that when I come to God with a need of convenience, right? Maybe it's a health or finance or relational, any number of things that man, if God, they're legitimate needs, they're legitimate concerns, and if God would meet this need for me, it would make things easier. It would be a blessing if he were to meet these needs. We have to remember that whenever we bring one of those needs of convenience to God, that's fine, but just know that his response is probably going to be, sure, I see that, but I also have a concern about this spiritual need. And I also notice that you have a spiritual need that we need to address, that needs met. So don't be surprised that if you bring him a need of convenience, that he goes, yeah, we'll get to that, but first here, I need to talk to you about something else. I need to point out something else. I want to teach you something, though, as we do this, as we go through this. Right? God's always going to prefer to meet your spiritual needs as or before he addresses your needs of convenience or your needs of comfort. That it's what he does. And we should expect that, and we should count on it and plan on it. In fact, you could even say we should budget for it. If I go to God and I'm going to ask him and talk to him and bring up a need of convenience, I just need to plan and set aside some of that space to go, I know you're going to bring it up, so let's talk about my spiritual needs too. Because I know this is your thing. This is what you do. Every need of convenience we bring to God, we should just be prepared to discuss our spiritual needs. And you're going to see this play out in the story, in the content here. And so look at verse 35. So he's teaching crowds. And remember, all the disciples, they go into, all right, here's our jobs, here's what we do, here we're going, guess who hasn't eaten yet? Right? Guess who hasn't eaten yet? And so verse 35, by this time it was late in the day. And so his disciples came to him and say, this is a remote place. There it is again. This is the wilderness. You brought us to the wilderness to rest? So now they're all here in the wilderness. We're all resting together in the wilderness. And they said, it's already very late. Send the people away so they can go to the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat. Okay, so this is the disciples, right? So you see here, you can kind of picture the hive of activity while Jesus does his ministry. They're not standing right next to him, right? And sometimes maybe you get this idea of they just kind of sit there on a rock and watch him while he's teaching, you know, and they're just there for the show too. No, they're out doing all sorts of things, as you can imagine. And finally, I don't know who suggested it, but someone's like, you know, hey Peter, you know, and we know Philip is involved in this conversation. They're like, hey, it's getting late, right? How long are we going to do this? He knows it's getting late. But somebody needs to say it, so they go to him and like, hey, maybe we should send people to go get some food. We're hungry. They're probably hungry. And they need to go, you know, find a village, find an inn, find someone that can give them some food. And they recognize that the people seem, maybe even Jesus seems, to have lost track of time. And given their location in the wilderness, they probably need to go find food in the surrounding villages. And so they bring that suggestion to Jesus because his teaching is what's keeping everyone from going and getting food. They're there because of what he's teaching. And his authority is what will send people away. They're like, look, I can tell them to go get some food. And they're just going to be like, yeah, no, he's still talking. And so they're like, hey, Jesus, if you would tell people, go find something to eat, they're going to go do it. They should do it with your authority. And so they suggest that. Stop teaching the people and tell them to go find some food. And the reality is there's nothing wrong with what they're doing. There's nothing wrong with what the disciples are doing here. In fact, it makes good sense. This makes a lot of sense, right? Where someone goes, hey, it's dinner. It's actually past dinner time. We gotta provide, like, they gotta go get something to eat. Like, we can't responsibly keep people here and without food, right? And so that it's a good idea. They're not challenging Jesus in this and saying, hey, you messed up. But Jesus does something odd. And he says this in verse 37, at the beginning of verse 37. He answers them, you give them something to eat. Okay? So remember that God meets people in the desert to test and bless. Right? He meets them a lot of times to challenge them and meets them in the desert for that purpose. Here we go. This is why we're in the wilderness. This is why God wants to meet us here, because he challenges his people here. This is what he does. And Matthew, when he writes about this, he tells us that Jesus actually says, they don't need to go. You give them something to eat. And at this point, practically speaking, if it was me, I would disagree. They do need to go, right? I don't know if you noticed, the backpacks we brought are empty. They do need to go. Like we weren't, if any of you have been a part of or planned a large event, like we did no prep for this event. We did no planning for a crowd of 15,000 people. There is no ship that has all of our supplies on it, you know. And the truth be told, there is some funding that they get. There are people that do provide things for them in villages where they're at, right? And with planning and preparation. But there's no supply ship coming in, you know, to drop off food for all these people. And so, practically speaking, if Jesus were to say this to me, and Father, forgive me, I would say, no, they do. I think they actually do need to go because we weren't ready for this, right? And I don't know what the other option is. The other option is you don't go and you stay here in the desert and you don't eat. That actually is the other option. There's only two options. They go find something to eat or Nobody eats, and we're all stuck here in the wilderness together. But even more confusing, Jesus doesn't just say, they don't need to go. He says, you give them something to eat. And John tells us, when he writes about this in his account, that after Jesus says this to them, Philip starts problem solving. Philip starts problem solving, and he and Jesus actually have a further conversation about this. They talk about this further, where Jesus actually asks Philip to consider, Philip, consider this, consider buying bread for everyone as a solution. Consider you go to the villages, and you guys buy bread for everybody. Jesus actually works him through this. They start problem solving on this. And now Jesus knows this isn't possible, right? He knows, like, that's not actually doable for the disciples to go buy food for everybody. But he wants to highlight the impossibility of the situation. And so he works Philip through the math. He wants it to be clear, like, this is a genuine problem. And so just to eliminate the option, he and Philip do the math. That binds on option. Look at verse 37. So they said to him, this is actually Philip. Philip's done the math with Jesus. So buying bread, food for everybody, that would take more than 200 denarii. That would take more than half a year's wages. We could work for 8 months and then we would have enough money to do that. Are we to go and spend that much on bread and give that to them to eat? Right? Some of you have decided that you wanted to throw a birthday party or something like that, and then you started doing the math and you're like, oh yeah, so our guest list's like 10. We can't feasibly just go and buy food for this many people. It's not cheap, right? And so your guest list, maybe you thought, yeah, we'd love to invite 50 people, right? And everybody gets a steak and stuff, and then you're like, you know what? Maybe hot dogs. And 50, no, maybe 20 people and hot dogs, and maybe everybody can bring something too, right? That'll cut costs. And next thing you know, you got a potluck, right? And everybody's coming and bringing their own, but hey, it's a party. And so they ask a very honest question. Are we going to go spend 200 denarii to feed this many people? Is this the cost of bread alone for 15,000 people by their math? In today's numbers, would cost about $26,000. That's not just laying around. That's a lot of money. And the disciples have, but now the disciples have a tension. They have this dilemma. Jesus told them, he didn't suggest, he told them, you give them something to eat. So they have to obey, right? They have to obey. He told them to do this, but they're stumped. I have no way to do this. Like, me giving them something to eat, the best solution is me giving them a kick in the pants to go to a village. Like, how are we obeying you in this? The ways that they would do it aren't going to work, and he doesn't want to send them away, and that makes the most sense, but we can't go afford to go buy food, so how are we supposed to obey? We have to obey, we know that, but practically speaking, we don't see how we can obey. This is a really tough situation to be in. How real is this for life, though? Life is very much about common sense and using common sense. And we can live out of the common sense that God has given us. And we all do. We all live out of our God-given common sense, where we know God would expect me to do the thing that makes the most sense here, the logical thing there. He gave me a brain. He made me wise to see situations and be responsible and reasonable and not get myself in places where I have to waste my resources, right? And we live out of common sense, and often we're able to live obediently to God within common sense, practically. But regularly, the truth is, if we're studying God's Word and we're listening to His Spirit speak through His Word and we're having these conversations with Him about our lives and about our situations and about our resources and all of those things, and we tell Him our thoughts and our reasonings and our concerns, there are moments when God is going to give us clear direction, or we have found that following Him has led us into a situation that circumvents conventional wisdom, that goes around common sense and leaves us facing our own lack of understanding, where we were following and rightfully following God blindly into a situation where all of a sudden we go, oh no, I don't have the understanding to go through to the next step. I don't know what I'm supposed to do here, because God is clearly asking me to obey, or clearly leading me in this way, and I'm out of resources. I'm out of understanding in my own common sense the way I've been living to obey here, to follow Him, and the things that I come up with aren't sufficient now. I don't know what to do. Just like with the disciples, this is on purpose. Christian living is full of moments where God leads us somewhere where we are incapable on our own to solve, to process, to work through with our own resources. And the truth is that Christian living is full of situations that exceed our God-given common sense. Christian living, the Christian life, following Jesus, following God, with our common sense, is inevitably going to lead us to situations that exceed our God-given common sense. They exceed our ability and our resources, and what we have, what we know, what we think is not going to be sufficient to understand and resolve the situation. We can only go so far with common sense before we're faced with a problem that's beyond us. The author of Ecclesiastes, we did a series in Ecclesiastes just recently, and the author of Ecclesiastes, he tested this. He tested, how far can I go with wisdom? How far can I go with my God-given common sense? And God gave him a lot of common sense. And he says this in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 13 to 18. He says, I applied my mind to study and to explore by wisdom all that's done under the heavens. What a heavy burden God has laid on mankind, I've discovered. I've seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them, in the end, are meaningless. They're a chasing after the wind. There's no substance to them, because what is crooked cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted. There are some things that are just dead ends, it feels like. There's just things that are twisted, and your common sense won't untie those knots. I said to myself, look, I have increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I've experienced much wisdom and knowledge. I have more common sense than anyone. And then I applied to myself to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly, everything. But I learned that this too is chasing after the wind. For with more wisdom, more common sense, more understanding comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. The more you understand and the more you follow down those paths, the more you learn, there's just more problems. There's just more knots. There's just more things that we cannot untie. We cannot understand. We can't resolve, because it's on purpose. Later on, that same author in Ecclesiastes is going to tell us that God intentionally ties knots in our understanding or in our situations and leads us into a bent and crooked path that is unresolvable on our own, on purpose. And now here he has the disciples in the wilderness with an unresolvable problem, and that's not a mistake. It's not like he went there and be like, oh, guys, we forgot $26,000. You forgot the wallets. Like, what? Really walked into this one. Like, that's not God. He brings you into the wilderness so he can meet you there, test you, bless you, and challenge you. And he's brought them into this situation on purpose to show them that following him often has moments and situations that exceed our God-given common sense, and he wants them to work through. There's nothing wrong with their suggestions until God says, here's what I need you to do. And now you have the dilemma of obedience that exceeds common sense. There are problems or situations that God intentionally allows in our lives or leads us into that we cannot solve on our own or navigate. And that's what we're seeing here with the disciples. This is where the disciples are. Now they're faced with the insufficiency of their understanding, and the situation is bigger than them. There's no clear path to a solution now. And then Jesus says this in verse 38. So he tells them, you give them something to eat. And they say, yeah, that's a lot of money. Verse 38, well, how many loaves do you have? He asks, go and see. Go start counting bread. People aren't leaving. You don't have enough money to buy dinner. Go figure out what you do have. Go start counting loaves. Go put in the legwork. And this is really interesting, because it turns out, if you remember, they also don't have food. The disciples hadn't eaten, right? They didn't have food. They were hungry themselves. I remember years ago, Pastor Sam used to do, I've shared this story before, he used to do the 30-hour famine. which is a fundraiser where youth groups starve themselves in order to raise money from people who will donate to their cause for children that don't have enough food in other countries, in third world countries. It's a really great cause. Pastor Sam added to that, he used to be the youth pastor here at Bethel, he added to that and would do a spaghetti dinner in the middle of the 30-hour famine. So he has kids who haven't eaten for like 16 hours, and then he's like, hey, let's serve everybody else food. And you don't eat it. And then I remember in the next morning, he would be warming up in the microwave this tons of spaghetti. But it felt cruel. Now Jesus is telling these guys, hey, I know you don't have food, and all those people are hungry, and you need to feed them. Go figure out what we do have. Go figure out what food there is. And the truth be told, this is a setup. It's a setup. And sometimes it is. Sometimes it is that Jesus needs us to see and learn a spiritual lesson. And he says, go figure out what we do have for food. And this would be tough. This would be tough work. They're seeing if they can scrounge up enough food to spread out among 15,000 people in the desert, and they have to do the legwork. And it doesn't turn up much. And I'm not sure if they were really expecting it to turn up much. John tells us in his account that they find a boy whose mom packed him a lunch who has 5 loaves and 2 fish in 15,000 people. They found a boy with a lunch, 5 loaves and 2 fish. Now, a lot is made of this boy sometimes, and people preach on his faith that, you know, bringing what little he had, and maybe he did. You know, maybe that was Jesus can use this. But maybe they made him give it up. I mean, it's the disciples, and they're walking. We need any food we need, any food you guys have, anything you guys got, anybody got food, right? And so maybe the disciples made him give it up. Maybe his mom forced him, be like, you know, you can't sit on them, they're asking, give it to him, right? And there's nothing said here in John's account. He's the one that tells us about it, about the boy's faith or anything, just that the disciples found a boy with some food. And that's actually revealing of something else wild to me. The disciples took Jesus' instructions so far that they're asking little boys for their lunch. That they were, this is what we have to be obedient in. We have to do this, right? They're asking little boys if they have any food, and there really wasn't anything to show for it. They did all of that obedience, and they came back with nothing. Just 5 loaves and 2 fish. And imagine this now. They bring it to Jesus, and he's like, so, what'd you find? And they've got to be like, well, obviously, we didn't bring any. We didn't bring anything with us. And we, when you said go to the wilderness, we figured you had this figured out. Turns out, you didn't bring any. So, in fact, only this boy was smart enough to bring anything. Everybody else just ran empty-handed. And he's got five loaves and 2 fish. And Jesus literally says, perfect, tell everybody to sit down. Which is not the reaction, the response that you would assume that he would give. Verse 39, Jesus directs them to have all the people sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in groups of hundreds and fifties. Now, it's been over 2 years, so at least the disciples are smart enough to not argue or anything like that, right? But they have to be mystified to an extent. But credit to them, in the face of a problem that goes beyond their ability to solve, they didn't just settle for the best they can do on their own. They committed to obey practically in faith. They were obedient. They went to find food, right? That they probably knew isn't going to be enough, you know. And now they're being obedient again and going around telling 15,000 people, making the trip back through everybody, to sit in these organized groups for distribution. Everybody sit down, we're going to distribute food. They know there's only 5 loaves and 2 fish. Everybody sit down, we're going to distribute food. Everybody have a seat. We need 50 over here, 100 over here. And this is just a thing that the children of Israel did. They did these 50s and 100 things. It was their way of organizing themselves. So they would have actually said it really fast, and people would have just been like 50, 100. That's how they organize themselves. But now these disciples are being obedient in another, like, all right, this is what he said to do. It doesn't make a lot of sense, but this is what he said to do. And this is kind of how the Christian life works in faith. Often in the face of problems, we have to demonstrate confidence in God's work without any idea of what his work is actually going to be. We have to be confident, and we have to obey in confidence and live confidently that God is going to work without any idea of what he's actually going to do. And that's what Christian living is. Christian living is very much about simple obedience and faith in the face of problems while God handles the solution. It's really what Christian living is there are simple things that God has asked me to do, simple, small things that I can be obedient in, and then have the faith that while I am obedient in these simple, regular things, that God is working on a solution, that God is doing something. And I don't necessarily even know what the solution is. I don't always know what the work is going to be. What I do know is he's asked me to be obedient in this. And you know what I can do? I can walk down a path and tell people to sit down. I can walk knowing that he's doing something and he's going to come through. I can walk through and ask for some fish or ask for some bread. If anybody has some food, I can do that because this is going to be God's solution and this is what he's asked me to do. I'm going to be obedient in the simple things, you know, in the face of a problem, knowing that God is handling the solution. This is Christian living. It's not huge, complex, big things that we have to do. It's simple obedience in the face of problems while God works on a solution. And we've got to tell ourselves sometimes, one step in front of the other. One step in front of the other and obey. I'm not really sure what he's going to do. I'm not really sure how things are going to work out. He's led me to this point, though. So what I need to do is the next obedient thing, knowing that he is doing something and things will work out in his way. And I love Psalm 37 in this verse. Psalm 37, verse 3 and verse 5 is profound and simple, where David says, here's what we need to do. Trust in the Lord and do good. Do what's right. Do the righteous thing, the obedient thing. And then he restates that in a different way. Dwell in the land and befriend faithfulness. Some versions say cultivate faithfulness, meaning you live where God has you and cultivate being faithful to him. Just do the obedient thing. Commit your way to God. Say, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be obedient, and you do your thing. Trust in him, and he will act. You just have to dwell in the land. Might be the wilderness. Might be somewhere that's got you flourishing. Wherever it is, you dwell there. You work on being faithful. You do what is right and obedient. Trust him, and he'll act. He will act. No matter what the problem is in front of you, commit to doing that. God will come through with a solution, whatever it is. We don't know what it is. The disciples had no idea what Jesus was going to do. They had no idea what he was going to do. They only knew that he's going to do something. Right? He's going to do something, and they know what obedience looks like in that situation. In the meantime, they don't know what he's going to do. They just know he's going to do, and they know that obeying him right now means I got to walk through these paths and tell people, sit down, we're going to distribute. Sit down, we're going to distribute. Right? That's what they know. And so they do good. They cultivate faithfulness. They trust Jesus, and they trust that he will act. And this is where we need to live every day. This is where we need to live every day. You know what obedience to God looks like. You know what it is. You avoid it sometimes, but you know what simple obedience to God is. You know the everyday details of living faithfully to God, of cultivating faithfulness. It's clear in his word, and his spirit will help you recognize it. And when we face problems that are beyond us, have that conversation with God. God, this is beyond me. This is tough. This is difficult. Talk about the common sense things. God, here's what I've done. Here's what I know you've asked me to do in this situation. And now I'm at the point where I don't know what else to do. This is where we it's gotten to the point where it's clearly beyond me. And then let go of your need to solve. And looking at that problem going, I got to solve this problem, and then say, so this is yours, and I'm going to do the simple obedience thing while you do your thing. I'm going to go focus on what obedience looks like in the moment, how to obey you now, and recognize this is now out of my hands. This is beyond common sense, and God is wanting to do something. My health is out of my hands. And just recently in the last year, I had some of those moments where I had to look at my health and recognize that this is my common sense is only getting me so far, and this is beyond my control. But I do know there's some small things, some little things now that I can continue to do. And while I'm doing those things, God, I know you've got a solution, and I know you've got this. This isn't mine to control. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to check my blood pressure. I'm going to take this medicine, and I'm going to be obedient in taking care of my body the way that you've asked me to take care of my body, and I'm going to trust that as I'm doing this, you work on a solution. You take care of this. And I'm sure you have those for yourself as well, where you reach a point where you have to go, I know what obedience looks like here, and I'm going to study his word, I'm going to pray, and I'm going to talk to him about this, and I'm going to lean on him, and I'm going to do all the responsible, good stewardship things, and I'm going to trust him that he's got a solution, he knows what he's doing, and focus on what the small steps of obedience are. And then keep your eye on God. And you can imagine as the disciples are walking down, sit down, sit down, sit down, keep an eye on God and just wait. Just wait and watch. Keep your eye on the problem solver and see. He will act while you cultivate faithfulness, simple obedience and faith. And while the disciples pursued simple obedience, Jesus acted. Look at verse 41. So taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish and looking up to heaven, he gave thanks and broke the loaves, and then he gave them to his disciples to distribute to the people. He also divided the 2 fish among them, and they all ate and were satisfied, and the disciples picked up 12 basketfuls of broken pieces of bread and fish. Jesus gave thanks. This is probably the traditional Jewish prayer that recognizes God's provision for 5 loaves and 2 fish. And then he started breaking the loaves. And I have a question. How many times was he breaking the same loaf of bread over and over? Break, here's a loaf. Break, here's a loaf. Like, can you imagine? There's 15,000 people, and he's just breaking loaf after loaf after loaf too many times. And then the same with the fish, right? And obviously, here's the moment of the miracle. Every time he broke a loaf, it was still whole. Every time it was still whole. And he wasn't handing out imitation bread. He's not handing out, you know, just fake pieces of bread or he's handing out pieces of genuine whole grain barley flour loaves of bread. Risen baked loaves of bread. He is handing every time he does this. What field did all that barley come from? Like, practically speaking, in our human minds, what field did all that barley come from? They didn't. That's what's crazy. There is no barley field somewhere in Israel completely empty now of grain because Jesus took it, right? There's no like artisan stoves, ovens anywhere that are now empty of wood because all of that wood was used to break enough to bake enough bread for all these people. Right? There's none of that. He just made whole baked loaves of bread, which is crazy. Thousands of fully risen loaves of barley bread out of nothing. And to that point, he did the same with the fish. This isn't imitation fish meat, right, that he's having them pass out. These fish he was distributing had all the qualities and meat of having formerly been alive, real fish. And as fishermen, the disciples knew what it took to catch that many fish. And yet there is no fishery now short of fish. And despite the fact that there are thousands of fish now in the hands of these people with real scales, real gills, real bones, right, real fish eyes, real fish meat, there's not a lake somewhere missing all of this fish. Out of nowhere, Jesus just created fully prepared barley bread and fully mature fish out of nowhere. This is a lesson, too, about Jesus as God. I said trust him because he's working on a solution, because God is easily capable of creating any solution for any problem. So trust him that he's working on something, because he could even do it out of nothing. Don't ever forget that. Don't let your problem or your own common sense become so prominent that you forget that God is able to create solutions out of thin air. Your situation is not bigger than God. Often he's just waiting for you to demonstrate that confidence and faith by plugging along in your simple obedience. I know you got this. I know you got this. There is no problem out there that God is not able to solve, literally out of thin air, if he wants to. And just like in this account, the solution is always satisfying. Always satisfying. And he is compassionate. He sees our needs, and he very much wants to create solutions for us that satisfy us. And a lot of times, we just need to do the obedient things. We don't have to worry about the solution. We just need to do the obedient thing. That's how we demonstrate that faith. Not just saying, I believe you can, but by continuing then to walk in simple obedience while God creates solutions. Appreciate that. Appreciate the solutions that God has created for you and creates for you and all the different ways he does it. And I'm sure he loved being a little bit creative here and going, watch this. He loves creating solutions, all while you simply obey. Now, I just want to finish take a quick look at the conclusion. Just one brief thought, verse 42. So they all ate and they were satisfied, and the disciples picked up 12 basketfuls of broken pieces of bread and fish. And the number of men who had eaten was 5,000. Why are there extras at the end? Jesus, as God, who creates the perfect solution always, is capable of creating exactly how much everybody needed to eat. He knew their caloric intakes. He knew how much to create that they would eat. But it seems like he overestimated by 12 baskets, doesn't it? He didn't. Remember who needed the rest and refreshment? Guess who was incredibly hungry at the end and then got to eat their fill? Guess who was concerned about meeting their spiritual needs and at the same time had a solution to meet their needs of convenience? And God said, you guys are hungry, you need rest. But first, I need to meet a spiritual need here for you. I need you to learn about simple obedience and my ability to create solutions. And then I'll meet your need of convenience. And this story and this event should play out in our lives regularly. God meeting spiritual and needs of convenience his own creative way while we follow him and live with simple obedience and faith, anticipating that we will act. And that is all you have to do. You just obey and let him meet all the other needs. Let me pray for you. Father, thank you for demonstrating your creativity. Thank you for showing us your desire, your compassion, your truth, and your grace all in this, that you see and that what you really usually are waiting for is just us to demonstrate that obedience while you work on a solution. And that's, God, that's hard. It's hard to not try to solve. It's hard to not question. It's hard to just keep doing what we know to be obedient. So today, as we walk into more dead ends and more tangles and twists, will you help us to be very aware and conscious of what it is to be obedient to you, and help us to have the presence of mind to just keep our eye on you and let you do your work as you meet our needs spiritually and in comfort. And I just want to say thank you now. As you go and meet our needs, is that we appreciate you and we recognize that it will be satisfying and we look forward to it. Surprise us, God. I love you. I pray this in your name.